Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood. We're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And this is a major novelty for me today. I'm doing this from the KPFA studio in Berkeley, live, because I'm in town for a conference. We've got two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with David K. Johnston, who is a former New York Times reporter who now is a columnist for Tax Notes and teaches at the Syracuse University School of Law, also, who is an expert on taxes and how rich people don't like to pay them, and what's happening with the U.S. income distribution, the rich are getting richer, etc. But he's also written lately about the benefits that we get from taxes and what exactly has been happening to the tax burden. So we'll talk about that sort of thing, inequality, wealth, taxes. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Michael Hudson, who is not the economist of the same name, but a journalist who has got out with a new book from Times Books, called The Monster, about how the subprime monster developed, and the connection, well, all the sleazeballs up front, but then the big Wall Street names in the back, and the whole pipeline, and how it came to be, and how it ended up driving the U.S. economy and much of the rest of the world into a very serious disaster. And just a few words before we get to all that. As I said, I was in town for a conference, the topic of which was New Deal / No Deal, organized by some folks at Berkeley, Michael Reich and Dick Walker and some others. And I was talking about taking the measure of the rot of the U.S. economy yesterday, and I began by just outlining something that an analysis that I'm sure that listeners who, to this show are familiar with, which is that the debt problem that the U.S. economy is deeply into now is in large part the result of a neoliberal strategy that was intended to cure, if you want to, you can't hear the quotation marks around cure, but they should be there, the economic problems of the 1970s, that is stagflation. Stagnation, stagnant growth, and high inflation. And actually, the growth, well, the 70s were universally thought of as a stagnant time. Actually, growth was more rapid then than it was during the 2000s. The 2000s have been a miserable decade for the U.S. economy. Not, of course, that growth is everything, but when we're not growing, our economic and social structures make things a lot more miserable than when we are. And if we want to change that fact, we have to change those structures. But after the problems of the 70s, the stagflation problem was solved or cured, quotation marks again, by launching an attack on wages and living standards and security of the bulk of the population. But for a system that depends on high levels of mass consumption for economic continuity, but also its political legitimation, there's a serious problem. When there's not enough income, not enough wage and salary income around to support high levels of mass consumption, so that problem was solved, so to speak, by many decades of rapid debt growth. And that model seems to have hit a wall in recent years since the collapse of the subprime bubble and the housing bubble and all that. We cannot go back to that model. And one of the reasons the economy is having such a hard time getting off the mat is that there's just no real growth in employment, no real growth in wages, and there's really not all that much credit available either to make up the difference. So we've got a real problem on our hands. So I'm just going to read some of the conclusion of the talk I gave yesterday to give a flavor of topics for future consideration, I suppose we might call that. What next? While the encouragement of clean energy and other green technologies would seem to hold great promise for generating fresh growth over the longer term, the political and financial system seem incapable of getting there. Our ruling class, such as it is, seems to have lost the capacity to think beyond the next quarter. New Jersey's thuggish new governor, Chris Christie, has just canceled his state's participation in a rail tunnel across the Hudson River. Or under the Hudson River, rather, a project that would not only create jobs in the in its construction, but would make long-term contributions to productivity growth, and not to mention human comfort. But he says that the state can't afford it, and he's not alone. A number of Republican candidates are running against the modest high-speed rail projects funded by last year's stimulus bill. I don't think it's only a budgetary thing. I suspect that they also think that trains are for pansies and real men get around in Escalades. It's a historical fact that many major industries in the U.S. got their start through public subsidies, from the railroads in the 19th century through the computer and pharmaceutical industries in the 20th. There would be no internet without the Pentagon. But today's political elite will hear little of this. There was a $5 billion fund for clean energy R&D in the stimulus package, but it was raided to fund the Cash for Clunkers program, a program with little economic and even less environmental payoff. My good friend Christian Parenti has written about how even something as mundane as a concerted public procurement program, a federal government buying lots of clean vehicles and such, could make a major difference in kickstarting a new industrial revolution, but the efforts so far have been rather feeble. Meanwhile, the Chinese have been building high-speed rail like crazy and are surging forward in solar and other green technologies. In a piece of the Chinese rail effort a few weeks ago, the Financial Times led with a vignette of Arnold Schwarzenegger shopping for equipment in Shanghai, as the paper put it, looking for trains, technology, and funding for the planned high-speed upgrade to the state's rail network, much of which was built in the 19th century by Chinese laborers. The Chinese rail sector is, it's worth pointing out, is dominated by state-owned firms. I was in a crazy TV debate with a Tea Party stockbroker type recently who was talking up how China is now much more capitalist than we are. I don't want to say that China's still state-heavy system is socialist exactly, but it's a lot more effective than our haphazard nonsense. But as I said earlier, our ruling class doesn't want to think that way. And to be honest, right now, they have no incentive to think that way. In my catalog of our economic woes, I forgot to emphasize the fact that the bourgeoisie hardly seems to be suffering. At least until recently, productivity has been rising strongly, not because of a rise in high-tech and investment, as it was in the late 1990s, but because employers are working their employees harder and paying them less, which delivers a nice fattening of profits and which is registered in the accounts as productivity gains. A friend who works as for a hedge fund told me the other day that 9% unemployment looks to be good for the stock market. Stay long capital, he spelled it with a K, and you should be okay, he advised. Of course, not all of us, those with only our labor power to sell, for example, can stay long capital. But as you may have noticed, this is not France. The unemployed do not burn cars, the already employed do not fight austerity, and high school students do not go on strike to defend old age pensions and stage enchanting kiss-ins in the process. You can draw lots of parallels between our recent bubble and the Gilded Age of the 19th century, but at least the first Gilded Age was spiced up by troublesome rural populists and urban socialists. Michael Reich, the chair of the panel I was speaking on, asked me to conclude my remarks with some questions that could serve as topics for discussion and future research. I'm happy to present these as questions since I really don't have any good answers for them. First, am I missing something in seeing little prospect for serious economic recovery? I've long lamented the left habit of seeing no way out of a future of endless stagnation. Capitalism is a resourceful thing, and to paraphrase J.P. Morgan, it's long been a mistake to sell short the United States of America. Mainstream types love to point out our wondrous flexibility, which is another way of describing what I could rather call our volatility and insecurity. And they also love to celebrate our record of innovation. But as the U.S. cuts back on R&D spending and on public investment and becomes more and more hostile to immigrants, is our advantage in innovation running out? Even the venture capitalists of Sand Hill Road out in the Silicon Valley are starting to look more to Asia than to their backyard. But it was also common to proclaim the end of the American century back in the 1970s, and that looks premature in retrospect. Is there some embryo lurking somewhere that will develop into something dynamic, or have we, as George Soros almost said a few years ago before the Council on Foreign Relations before stopping himself, have we shot our wad? And what about our ruling class? I said a little while ago that it looks incapable of thinking beyond the next quarter. I've been thinking of writing a book on our ruling class, some sort of hybrid of C. Wright Mills and Vanity Fair, but I set it aside for personal reasons. But I'd like to turn back to it soon. My working hypothesis was that nothing coherent has replaced the old northeastern WASP elite as a ruling stratum. Though it was often greedy and brutal, it also had a disdain for commerce and an ethic of stewardship that helped it plan the post-World War II order with some degree of actual vision and skill. From its point of view, not necessarily that of the masses of the world. Its members went to the same schools, belonged to the same clubs, and married from the same small, homogenous pool. But now, to use the jargon of Wall Street, the transaction has replaced the relationship. It's all about who can make the most money the most quickly, and the long term can hang itself. Can a complex hierarchical society really be run by such a depraved social formation? Can the U.S. elite reconstitute itself as in the past, as it has many times in the past? For a while, I thought Obama might represent some sort of rationalization of the system, some efforts of repair after the decadence of the Bush years, but it's not really turning out that way. Neither he nor his paymasters seem interested or capable of such a project. This is another view of our economic slowdown. I don't think that an elite can stay rich and powerful while their society's foundations rot underneath it. But am I right in this? Or can the oligarchy barrel ahead while everything else around them goes to hell? I hope there's someone out there who can answer these questions. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with David K. Johnston. And that was some of Rich by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And we had some trouble raising David K. Johnston, and so I excised that portion of the show where the trouble was all too audible to the audience, and now we're going to slide into where we finally nabbed him. David K. Johnston, who is a columnist for Tax.com and a longtime reporter for the New York Times and author of quite a few books.
Okay, I think we finally have nailed David K. Johnston. Okay, are you with us, David K. Johnston?
I am!
Thank you. I'm doing this out of a strange studio, and there's some kinks in the system, so, but now we've got you. Welcome.
Well, glad to be here, Doug.
So, let's talk a little bit about, you found some data for the Social Security Administration on the wages of the mass of the American workforce that didn't get an awful lot of attention. Tell us what you found with that Social Security wage data.
Well, there's a flat tax on all compensation, the Medicare flat tax. And so unlike all these other data sources we have that are complicated, this one is to the penny how much everyone in America got in salary and bonus who had a job. It turns out that in 2009, every 34th person who'd had a job in 2008 had no work all year. They did not earn a penny from their labors for the entire year. That's extraordinary. Usually people are out of work for much shorter periods than that. When you add the fact that there's another 1.5 million people who, because of growing up, join the workforce every year, you're looking at 6 million people who went the entire year who should have been in the workforce not making a penny. Then we find from this data that total compensation, average compensation, and median, that is half more, half less, were all lower in 2009 than in 2000. Well, that's probably not particularly surprising, but the median wage, half make more, half make less, was smaller than it was in the year 2000. 10 years later, half of workers are making less money than they were in the year 2000. That's pretty shocking. And then at the other end, Doug, at the very top, The Social Security Administration is unique among all the government agencies. It doesn't cut off the highest level of either $1 million or $200,000 or $1 million or $10 million. It goes to the $50 million level.
The point being, when the Census Bureau does its annual income numbers, that's called top coded. So
that's right. And they understate the number of people at the very top. But here you get actual numbers. This isn't surveys like the Census does or statistical samples like the IRS does. This is the actual raw numbers. Well, in 2007 and 2008, there were 150 and 130 people who made more than $50 million, and they made a little over $90 million each year. This is salary and bonus, not people selling their business, not hedge fund managers. These are employees. In the year 2009, the recession year of 2009, there were only 74 people, not 150 or so, only 74, but their average pay went up from the low 90 millions to $519 million. That's virtually $10 million a week. Now, I frankly, Doug, I have a hard time imagining what labor you could possibly do. How smart you are as an employee, how you can earn an economic income where you added to the company's value enough to be paid on average $10 million a week. And there were 74 of these people at this phenomenal. I mean, $500 million for a year's work.
Who are these people be? CEOs? Ball players?
Well, there's one CEO who may be on the list, Larry Ellison at Oracle. He's the only one who could be on the list, and he may well not be on the list. The other possibilities are disclosure of executive pay is very narrow. It's only five named officers. Or as the old saying goes, if World War II had been a corporation, we would not have known how much the most important leaders, Admiral Halsey and Generals MacArthur and Eisenhower, made, only what Omar Bradley made because he was in Washington. So it could be executives who have been to the company for many years who are cashing out deferrals. You know, you and I can save $16,000 and change in a 401k plan. If you're over 50, you can save $22,000. But there's a special law for executives, movie stars, athletes, and top salespeople who are allowed to get unlimited amounts of income without paying income taxes on it currently. And then they collect years later, and then they pay the taxes. So possibly it's some executives with long, long, long deferrals who decided 2009 the stock market was up, 2011 tax rates would probably go up, time to cash out and leave. The biggest likelihood, however, is that they are Wall Street traders. And this is where the difference between the Bush and Obama administration bailouts is really crucial to understand, and it's clear most of the public does not. When Obama bailed out Detroit, he wiped out the shareholders of General Motors and Chrysler. He partially wiped out the executive deferral accounts, the ones I was just talking about, and everybody had to take a pay cut. But when Bush bailed out Wall Street, there was no wiping out of the shareholders, no wiping out of the executive deferral accounts, and no reform of pay practices. So if you were a Wall Street trader and you bet the right way in 2009, which essentially meant betting against the American economy at one time of the year and for it another time of the year, you could have made the kind of money for the company where your commission, your bonus, would put you in this league.
Now, I'm wondering, do these guys have bad lawyers and accountants if they structure this all as salary? Isn't there some way to evade these taxes?
Well, there are lots of different ways to certainly do this, and it's one of the biggest problems. Hedge fund managers, for example, are not in this if they're the actual manager of the plan. Now, you might be a trader at a hedge fund, and you would have to be in this plan. But if you're one of the owners, you get what's called carried interest. The news media routinely reports this as you would pay 15% tax rate instead of the 35% tax rate that high wage earners pay on the margin. In fact, the current tax rate of hedge fund managers is zero so long as they defer. So we had one hedge fund manager in 2009 who made, I think it was $4.9 billion. Assuming he deferred in his account offshore, he would not owe any tax at all. And even if he did, he wouldn't appear in this database because he'd be taxed as capital gains, even though he had no capital at risk. It was his customer's capital that was at risk. So, yes, the law, well, there are lots of loopholes in law that let people take labor income as capital income and pay lower tax rates. There are many people who cannot pull that off because of their job.
Now, we're just talking about wage income here, right? So this is not not investment income, not income,
that is correct.
Dividends, interest, capital gains, anything
That's
like that.
That's right. This is only one component. This is not income. This is salary and bonus. But salary and bonus come to about 70% of all the income that Americans report each year. And then labor-like income brings it up to almost 90%. And by labor-like income, I mean pensions. That's just deferred wages you collect later. Withdrawals from 401k plans, which even though that's stock market gains, you don't get the capital gains rate. You have to pay the income tax rate, which is usually almost always higher. And other unemployment insurance, which is now taxable and has been since the Reagan years. So most of the income people report in America is labor income.
You've also been writing about some broader statistics that economist Thomas Piketty and
Emmanuel Saez have been looking at. What's been going on at the extreme top end of the distribution? How does it compare with the bottom 90%?
Well, since I took the Saez-Piketty data and compared it to an anomaly I found in the IRS statistical data for the year 1961. And since 1961, the after-tax, after-income tax income, not payroll tax, not Social Security, just income tax, the after-income tax income of the vast majority of Americans, the bottom 90%, has gone up 50%. Now, that means for every dollar you earned in 1961, you got a penny a year more, actually a little less than a penny at the end of the 46 years. And you ended up, a little more than a penny, and you ended up with $1.50 more income, 50% more income after almost a half century. What happened with the top 400? Well, their income went up $35.50 to one. That's a ratio of $71 to one. So each time each person in the bottom 90% got $1 of increased income, people at the very top got $71 of increased income. The tax burden of people on the bottom 90% went down. It went down 20%. But the tax burden of people at the top went down 61%. Now, if we put payroll taxes back into the mix, it does not change the numbers for people at the very top because, remember, Social Security stops at about $100,000. And for people at the bottom, then their increased pay after 50 years is 20 cents. So for every dollar the bottom 90% made in 1961, after all federal taxes, they get $1.20. That's less than a half a penny a year per dollar increase in income.
If you start as early as 1961, that was a time when the masses were doing a little better. If you start the clock more recently, I think the difference is even more lopsided, isn't it?
Well, the other thing I did with the Saez and Piketty data was this. You know, the vast majority of Americans, two-thirds of Americans, have only known Reaganism because Reagan was elected in 1980. His term began in 81. So unless you were born before 1960, your life's experience is entirely as an adult been Reaganism. So I looked at, well, what happens within the top 5% if you look at the period from 1950 to 1980 and then 1980 till 2008, the new data. And it turns out, excluding the very, very, very top, the top 0.01%, the closer you got to the top in income, the slower your income grew in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. In fact, if you were in the group from the top 0.1% up to the top 0.01%, your income grew at only 1/5. The rate of the vast majority. But since 1980, that's been reversed. And the higher you are on the income ladder, the more and more you get. And that, I think, is the fundamental lesson of what our economic policies since 1980 under both Democrats and Republicans have been doing.
Yeah, almost
more
all,
and more for fewer and fewer.
Almost all the benefits of economic growth have gone to the richest 1% of the population for the last couple of decades, right? That's not an exaggeration.
Not an exaggeration, but more importantly, more than half has gone to the top 10%, and more than half of that has gone to the top 0.01%. So it's incredibly concentrated at the very top. Now, critics will come back to my work and they'll say, but wait a minute. People go into that group and they come out of that group. And that's true. You know, somebody has one big year where they make $50 million. Maybe there's Sarah Palin, who we know from the public record made approximately $12 million last year. That puts her in the top 0.01%. Not interesting position for the woman of the people, Sarah Palin. And she may or may not be in that in the future. People at the very top have very high incomes for a while. Dick Cheney made $40 million one year. He never made that much again. On the other hand, once you've made $40 million or $50 million or $12 million, you should be well off for the rest of your life.
Well, and even so, they fall out of the top 0.01%. They don't fall into the bottom 90.
No, they don't. Typically, they don't. We do know of a few famous cases I wrote a book about back 20 years ago called Temples of Chance, who gambled away their fortunes. But with those rare exceptions of people who are addicted to gambling, that's exactly correct. You might fall to the second. You probably fall, say, in the 1%. Maybe if you really abused your money, you might fall into the top 2%.
My first reaction when I hear these things is this is terrible, but most Americans don't seem to care about this all that much. But you reported also recently on a poll about what people think the wealth distribution is and what they would like to see it as. Give us a quick summary of that. We've only got a few minutes left here.
5,500 Americans were shown pie charts of wealth distribution and asked to pick what they thought was the ideal. Republicans and Democrats, young and old, high income and low, all picked the same. They all picked the model that turns out to be the actual wealth distribution of Sweden. Then they were asked, what do you think is the actual distribution in the United States? Well, 90% of the same things, Republicans, Democrats, etc., assume that the poorest 120 million Americans own between a quarter and a fifth of all the wealth in America.
That's the bottom 40% of the population?
The bottom 40% own 20 to 25% of the wealth. In fact, the bottom 40% own 0.3%. They don't own every fourth or fifth dollar. They own every 333rd dollar. Now, I think this is actually good news, that Republicans and Democrats, rich and poor, men and women, share the same ideals, suggests that we are being manipulated by people who are getting rich off this. And who's getting rich off your not knowing this and your the misinformation and the outright lies that are being spread? Well, those people in the political donor class who want to enjoy their billions of dollars and make you pay the taxes for them, and who are selling this notion that if they don't get tax cuts, you won't have a job, when the exact reverse is true. High taxes discourage withdrawals from business and encourage business owners to reinvest in the business rather than withdraw money from it.
Well, right now we're looking at, you know, the corporate balance sheets are just flush with cash. Profits are high, and they're not investing or hiring. And
that's right. American corporations have a record $1.8 trillion plus in cash. That's about $6,000 for every man, woman, and child. When interest rates are virtually zero, that money's actually rotting. It's losing value over time because they can't figure out where to invest it profitably. Well, the reason you can't profitably invest it is that we have so reduced the incomes of people in the bottom 90%, they can't buy anything. 4.5 million people out of work for the whole year of 2009, 1.5 million more who entered the workforce and didn't get any work, median wages lower than when Clinton left office, and virtually no job creation during the Bush years. Fewer jobs created during the Bush years than during the Eisenhower years when the population was much smaller. And the problem is, you know, all this stuff I'm telling you has not been basically in the national media. I offered every one of the TV networks, I called producers at them, all three cable networks, an exclusive on this stuff before I broke it. I went to the New York Times, where I used to work, and to the other major newspapers. Nobody would do this. In fact, one TV producer said to me, well, who announced this? And I said, well, nobody announced that the numbers were posted on the Internet without announcement. Well, so who analyzed it? I analyzed it. Oh, okay, well, we'll get back to you. We've got news media by press release. And as somebody who spent 40 years reporting, I find this very distressing.
I should say, you're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, and our guest here is David K. Johnston. And someone who still works at the New York Times once joked to me that his job was rather easy because all he had to do was write a sentence and then say, official said Tuesday.
Well, I think the standards are higher than that, but I understand the basic point. I mean, we've had 30 years, Doug, of serious efforts to cow reporters. My last book, Free Lunch, I wrote about a reporter at a small paper, the Galveston County News in Galveston, Texas, Daily News. Every time he wrote a story about Reliant, the big electric utility, as many as 11 PR people were on him and his publisher. When David Lazarus was at the San Francisco Chronicle, AT&T had a vice president whose job apparently was principally to get rid of Lazarus. And AT&T for years would not advertise in the Chronicle because of what Lazarus wrote. And all he did was write truthful stories about the pricing that AT&T was engaged in. They never once were able to show a flaw in his reporting. They simply did not want the public to know this. And this is a real serious problem. And simply saying the news media is not doing its job is not going to change anything. That will not change anything. You want to change it, people need to write cogent letters to, like, the public editor of the New York Times, public@nytimes.com, the standards editor at the New York Times, standards@nytimes.com, the ombudsman at the Washington Post, and, you know, polite but cogent letters. Why is this not being reported in your newspaper?
But, you know, it seems like while the such class rages as exists in the public sphere is directed against, immigrants and Harvard professors. It's not the corporate and financial elite.
Well, that's what we're seeing covered in the news. The surveys actually show something quite different. Fox News did a poll just before tax day, and here's what it showed. Favorability ratings. Number one favorability rating, Obama, 50%. Number two, the IRS, just before tax day, 49%. Where was Sarah Palin? 24%. 24%. So the IRS is more than twice as popular with the American people as Sarah Palin. But you wouldn't certainly know that from Fox, and you wouldn't know it from seeing most news shows.
Now, Fox commissioned this poll, but they didn't report it.
Yeah, the lots of them. I've written about a number of Fox polls. You want to be well-informed, go to the web. The Fox puts its polls up on the web. They come from a legitimate, serious polling outfit. They're the ones who do the poll year after year about how many Americans think they're being followed around by an angel. It's in the 40% level. How many think there are witches? About 24% of Americans who believe in witches. It's kind of scary stuff.
It is. Well, actually, most Americans believe in heaven, and most people think they're going there. So
yeah.
That's a lot of wish fulfillment that pollsters discover. All right, so how can people find your excellent columns, tax.com?
Tax.com is the free public website of tax analysts. They're a nonprofit that has for 40 years been suing and doing journalism to get the IRS and the state tax systems to be open. And tax.com is where some of my columns are posted. I think there's about 6 or 8 of them up there, including one on the public benefits of taxes. From a study in Canada. Nobody's ever done a study like this in the U.S. So, yes, I hope people bookmark tax.com. We have a lot of information up there. We publish about 250 pages a week, no advertising, 250 pages a week of tax journalism, and run one of the largest newsrooms in Washington with 31 reporters. Reporters and editors.
How's it funded then?
Subscriptions. I actually write for something called Tax Notes, which people pay a couple grand a year for, and it's read by everybody who's a serious player in the tax world. And after all, tax is the biggest business in the world. It's 40% of the world economy.
And lots of people trying to avoid them. All right. Thanks for joining us, David K. Johnston. I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, a former reporter for the New York Times, who is now a columnist at Tax Notes and teaches sometimes at the University of Syracuse School of Law. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Sub Prime with Mike Hudson. And that was some of the Soft Boys song, I Want to Destroy You. That got played a little prematurely during the David K. Johnston service earlier, but now here it is restored to its rightful place. Okay, back to the original show.
Now we should be joined on the line by Michael Hudson, who is the author of the book The Monster, just out from Times Books, and not the economist of the same name, but a longtime journalist. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So, you've been at this beat for a long time now. I think I had you on the show when you did a collection for Common Courage Press many years ago about sleazy lenders then, right?
Right, it was a book called Merchants of Misery. That would have been 96 or 97.
Yeah, and then you did a big piece, a big investigation for Institute for Southern Studies, Southern Exposure, right?
Right, I did a lot of reporting on Citigroup and their subprime behemoth.
But things grew even bigger in the subsequent years, didn't they?
Right. I mean, early 90s, mid-90s, the subprime mortgage business was a pretty small space. It was on the margins, and it grew thanks to Lehman Brothers and other Wall Street firms that opened the pipeline of cash to these lenders, many of which were based in Orange County, California. Opened the pipeline and really turned the small market into a monster that was capable of crashing our economy and sp- sparking a global crisis.
Now, let's talk a bit about where your book starts, Orange County, California. Why is this such an epicenter of sleazy financial practices?
That's a good question. You know, I spent quite a bit of time out there. A lot of great people people I enjoy meeting with, and it's a beautiful place. But it's also there's also this sort of frontier mentality. And also the political conservatism, this idea that any sort of government regulation is evil, and that you know we need to have a free market. So there's a sort of cowboy capitalism there that over the years has made Orange County the biggest home to old-fashioned boiler rooms, you know, selling worthless stock and precious metals and that kind of thing, and lots of real estate fraud too. Part of it is the county grew. It went from a couple hundred thousand around the time of World War II to millions now. And so the sense of growth and this, and you know, there's not a lot of old money, and so you live in a place where people don't ask you how you make your money.
Yeah, that was an interesting point you made. That it seems that having old money around does. People ask questions, but when it's nothing but nouveaus running around, it's like a no questions asked ethic.
Right, and so it was really a perfect place for subprime to grow, and there were a couple small savings and loans based in Orange County that really were the early pioneers in the subprime market. One was called Guarding Savings and Loan, and the other was Long Beach Savings and Loan.
Yeah, no, also you mentioned savings and loans. Orange County was also a major center of the savings and loan disaster of the 80s, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Some of the worst S&L malefactors were there, including Charles Keating of Lincoln Savings and Loan fame.
Who is also an old friend of John McCain's, right?
Right.
And got a character witness from Alan Greenspan.
He was, you know, Alan Greenspan, in between government gigs, hired himself out as a consultant, and he wrote a letter to federal banking regulators that said that Lincoln Savings Management was seasoned and expert, and that there was no chance that the S&L was going to go under and cost the taxpayers anything. He turned out to be, as we know, he turned out to be wrong. It cost the taxpayer something like $2.66 billion.
And this, of course, is the man who said there was no housing bubble and nothing to worry about with subprime.
He has had to come back over the years quite a bit and say I was wrong, say there was a flaw in my analysis, a flaw in my, and more recently, a flaw in my assessment of how the world works.
My then 3-year-old son looked at a picture of Alan Greenspan after having said that, looking rather anguished, and he said, why is this man sad? It's kind of hard to explain Alan Greenspan to a 3-year-old, but his sadness was palpable. Now, was there any continuity between the S&L players and of the 80s and the subprime of the 90s and 2000s?
Right. The one S&L that really did more than any to create the subprime market was Long Beach. It eventually morphed into Long Beach Mortgage and eventually split off. Long Beach Mortgage became property of Washington Mutual and helped Washington Mutual make lots of money, and then helped Washington Mutual crash and burn and become the biggest bank failure in American history. The other part of Long Beach Mortgage became Ameriquest, and Ameriquest became the biggest and baddest of the subprime lenders. Its owner was a guy named Roland Arnall, who was a huge political contributor. He actually gave to a lot of Democrats back in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. But he began to change in this new century. He became Bush's biggest contributor during the biggest source of cash during the 2004 election cycle. Bush later rewarded him by appointing him his ambassador to the Netherlands. And thanks to subprime, Roland Arnall became a billionaire three times over. He was worth about $3 billion at one time, according to Forbes.
And the epigraph of your book is from him, Stuff Happens.
Stuff Happens. When they ask him why his company was so rife with bad practices and predatory lending and taking advantage of borrowers. And he said, it was a little bit longer than just stuff happens, but basically at any company where you have thousands and thousands of people, stuff happens.
Now, he is quite a character. I mean, people say he was a generous man personally, although capable of great rages as well. But give us a little capsule bio of his rise to riches.
Right. He was an immigrant from France, came over with his family, I think around 1950. In his early days, he and his brother sold flowers and I think maybe eggs and apples on the street and around in and around Los Angeles. He made enough money to buy a house. He then sold that house and used that money to become a real estate developer. So he was a developer in L.A. in the late 60s and early 70s. And, you know, he really got into the close connection between the real estate interest and the people, office holders there in L.A. So he learned about influence peddling from some of the best. And eventually he started a savings and loan.
But he is lending himself money as a developer, wasn't he?
What's that?
He used the savings and loan to lend himself money when he was a developer, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the idea was to use the SNL as kind of a cash cow to get money to help bankroll his projects. And he was also bankrolling other sort of real estate projects, too. But eventually, as the savings and loan debacle became clear and regulators, they started putting a little bit of pressure on him to diversify. And so his way of diversifying was to go into mortgage lending, and they didn't make much money at first because they were just doing, you know, kind of generic loans. But then they had the idea of start doing subprime type loans to people with modest incomes or dinged credit. And they found that there was a real profit center there. And at first, I don't think the loans were that predatory. I don't think they were that bad. He had some folks working for him who were gatekeepers who kind of reined him in. But eventually, I think, as with many empire builders, he got rid of the early folks who helped him build the business and the folks who kind of sat on him and kept him, you know, and kept him from exercising his baser instincts. By early to mid-90s, he was pretty much running the show himself and was really incentivizing his people to say and do whatever it takes to sell loans. And that's when the kind of boiler room culture in his companies began to flourish.
And his mantra was, we can do twice that, right?
Right. Anytime somebody said, you know, there was a story where they were trying to hire some managers away from Transamerica, another lender, and they had like a celebratory dinner after the guys had promised they were coming over, and they were going to resign en masse, and at a dinner, and he went around the table, and you know, everybody was kind of liquored up at this point, and asked them, you know, well, how much volume can you do in a month? And they all were a little loose because they'd been drinking, so they gave really very, very optimistic totals of what kind of loan volume they could produce, and with each one, he would say, well, you know, we can do that. We can do twice that much. And so what happened in the end is only one of these Transamerica guys actually made the jump over. The theory was, among some of Roland's people, that they just kind of got scared. I mean, they knew about pressure, but they'd never seen anything, you know, like Roland.
Now, Roland is the star of the book in some ways, but there are many others rather like him and created an industry of creating loans with rather creative use of documentation, right? They were white out and cut and paste and all kinds of things going on.
Right. At AmeriQuest, many of the employees told me, you know, that some of the most important tools were white out and X-Acto knives and scotch tape, because they would outfit the, you know, break rooms or spare cubicle with these tools, and they would use them. It was basically they were the fraud workshops. They would cut and paste documents. If you had someone who couldn't afford a loan, you would take someone else's W-2 tax form, you know, the end of the year thing that tells you how much money you make, and you would paste the first borrower's name onto the second, run it through a Xerox machine, and suddenly, presto, you had a piece of paper which showed that this bad loan prospect actually was a good loan prospect. And so there was a lot of this cutting and pasting. There was a lot of and they would joke. They would call these little workspaces the art department or the lab. And there were a lot of tricks they played, and they would forge people's signatures on key loan disclosures so they didn't actually know what they were getting.
I'm speaking with Mike Hudson, author of The Monster, just out from Times Books. And The Monster refers to a practice which was lying without lying, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, partly it's just a recognition that this subprime market grew from from this tiny space to this monster. But it also draws inspiration from a portion of a sales sales pitch that one of the subprime lenders, First Alliance Mortgage Company, which was closely associated with Lehman Brothers, used to draw the borrowers in. The monster was this really brilliantly crafted presentation that sought to plant in people's minds that the interest rate didn't matter and that they could pay a high interest rate and still save money. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but you have to understand that the presentation was really quite effective, and that it was part of an even larger presentation that was aimed at clouding people's thinking and using their hopes and fears against them. The salesman called it finding the pain. You would ask a lot of skillful questions about people's hopes and dreams and worries, and if you could get them to cry, that was ideal. As a matter of fact, one former salesman said his manager would give him bonuses for getting people to cry, and then they would call around at the end of the week to see which branch had the most people crying. Because once you've got people to cry, you can comfort them, and you can offer them a solution to their problems. You can help them wipe away their worries. And, of course, the solution is a loan from us. And ultimately what would happen is a lot of pretty smart people, you know, just average folks, would end up stuck with loans where they were paying as much as $20,000 in upfront points on a $100,000 loan.
And some of these, they were, you know, lying without technically lying, but in some of it, there's also a lot of outright lying involved.
Right, and you know, one of the skills that some of the salespeople at various companies told me was the ability to not answer a question without appearing not to answer. You know, if someone said, "Well, what's the interest rate going to be?" You say, "Well, I'm glad you asked that. You know, we're one of the biggest companies in the mortgage business, and so we have access to some of the best rates. And you know, we're not a one size fits all company. We're gonna tailor the rate to what's best for you. You know, and on and on and on." And they wouldn't answer the question. So these folks were very skillful. One of the loan officers for First Alliance said, people would ask him, "Well, are these people stupid? They're paying 20 points up front. What's their problem?" And he said, "No, they weren't stupid. It was just that we were that damn good."
That 20 points on a mortgage, people are paying 20%, fees of 20% of the mortgage up front, right? And then paying interest on that. That's just absolutely remarkable. What's a more normal point?
Oh, 1 point, 2 points.
So it's and people are paying this and then paying large interest rates on top of it.
Right. I mean, normally when you pay points, you expect that your interest rate is going to go down. But in this case, people they'd pay the points and they would still pay a pretty high rate.
And a lot of this wasn't first mortgages to buy a house. A lot of it was home equity loans and such, right, and refinancings.
Right. It's interesting. You know, Ameriquest always advertised itself as the proud sponsor of the American Dream, and they would hit whenever they have a press releases, and they did a lot of PR work. You know, they would build Habitat for Humanity houses, and all their press releases would talk about helping with home ownership. But the interesting thing about Ameriquest was they were a refi shop. They made very few home purchase loans. Almost all of them were just home equity loans. And so, you know, 99% of their loans were refinancings, which weren't helping to increase home ownership. They were actually helping to put people's houses at risk by loading them up on debt.
Now, of course, we've been talking mostly about the sleazeballs at the front end of this process, but at the back end, there are some of the finest names on Wall Street, right?
Right. Just about everyone on Wall Street had a hand in this. I focus on Lehman Brothers because they were the biggest and most aggressive player in terms of bankrolling subprime. There was a 11 or 12 year stretch starting the mid 90s. In which Lehman ranked either number one or number two for the volume of subprime mortgages it rolled into these mortgage-backed securities investment deals. It was also one of the most aggressive Wall Street players in cutting out the middleman and buying lenders so it could make subprime mortgages directly to the consumers. I talked to something like two dozen former employees of Lehman's, you know, in-house subprime units, and they told me the same kind of stories that I'd heard at Ameriquest and elsewhere, that fraud was common and that falsifying people's incomes and property values was something that was either encouraged or winked at.
So it wasn't just you know, the disreputable folks in Orange County, but you know, these high-prestige folks in Wall Street are doing the same thing.
Right. Well, you know, to me, the story is when Orange County, the cowboy capitalism culture in Orange County got together with Wall Street. You put those two together, and it really spelled disaster for the country and for millions of people.
Now, I think Lehman and such like to present themselves as innocent, somehow duped, or you know, things were going on they didn't really know about, but they really knew what was going on, didn't they?
Right. Well, you know, an example is going back to the First Alliance mortgage case. back in 95, Lehman was thinking about doing business with them, helping to bankroll them. They sent a vice president out to Orange County to check out FAMCO, First Alliance. He came back and wrote this scathing memo describing the lender as a financial sweatshop that specialized in high-pressure sales to people in a weak state, as a place where you checked your ethics at the door. This apparently didn't bother top Lehman executives very much over the next few years, because they said, hey, we'll do business with them. Over the next few years, they helped FAMCO raise hundreds of millions of dollars to bankroll its lending and continued bankrolling First Alliance even after other Wall Street banks decided they didn't want anything to do with the company.
There's several interesting appearances made by Deval Patrick, now the governor of Massachusetts. How did he fit into this story?
Right, it's interesting. I actually have been getting calls from reporters in Boston. Apparently, the Republicans up there are passing around copy my book or pages from my book to try and in their effort to discredit Deval. Deval was a assistant attorney general. He was in charge of the Civil Rights Division in the mid '90s. The Civil Rights Division went after Long Beach Mortgage, one of Roland's earlier subprime lenders, accused it of racial discrimination, targeting racial and gender and age discrimination, targeting elderly, African American, Hispanic, and older borrowers for much higher rates than it was charging others.
And which we should emphasize was rampant throughout this story, right? Very intensely racial subtext to a lot of this.
Absolutely, and you know, one of the Justice Department lawyers told me that the salesmen at Long Beach were pretty, pretty frank, you know, and they would say things like, well, you know, when you've got an older, you know, and to me, it's not so much about the customer, it's really about their mindset, which the mindset creates reality. But they would say, when you've got an older black woman, you can pretty much sell them anything. And that was the idea. And, you know, Deval Patrick, he didn't get into the nitty-gritty of the investigation, but he oversaw the investigation. Eventually, Ameriquest settled for $4 million. It really was sort of a cost of doing business that allowed Roland to go on and keep growing, and Roland's companies didn't change their practices. Afterwards, you know, one of the Justice Department lawyers who was really involved in the investigation came away feeling like Roland was really, you know, not very good about Roland, and you know, Roland had invoked his sainted mother. How can I tell my mother that I'm being investigated for human rights violations by the Justice Department? And the lawyer felt that was kind of crass. But Deval Patrick came away feeling good, and he actually mentioned, well, you know, we sat around the table and he talked about his mother, and I came away feeling he was somebody who wanted to do the right thing. So you flash forward to 2004, 2005, and suddenly Roland's new company, and now really a huge monster, the largest subprime lender, is being investigated by a bunch of different state attorneys general and banking agencies. And he hires Deval Patrick to be on the board of his holding company at $360,000 a year. And Deval, he sort of tries to use Deval as his as a little bit of a shield to say, see, I'm a good guy, you know, I've got this African-American public official who has a history of you know, fighting for civil rights. And so that kind of got Deval in trouble, and that's been raised in the 2006 election when he ran for governor and won in Massachusetts, and it's being raised again.
And he even made a call to Bob Rubin, right, to get some money for Ameriquest when they're in trouble.
He did. While he was sitting governor early in 2006, as Ameriquest was, as the market was starting to slow down, he called and vouched for the character of Ameriquest management. He also vouched for Roland Arnall's character when Roland Arnall was up for the ambassadorship to the Netherlands. So he came away feeling that Roland was a pretty good guy.
Well, actually, some of the real good guys in the book I noticed are state investigators, state attorneys general, regulators and such. Were the feds asleep throughout all this?
They were not asleep. They were actively working to prevent the states from doing anything. Anytime a state would go after a major lender that was had any connection to a nationally, you know, licensed bank, the federal banking regulators would come in and say, hands off, and invoke the power of federal preemption and say, there are, you can't do anything with them. They in some cases, they would sue to stop the states from taking action. And in most cases, the states would have to drop their have to drop their investigation.
Why did the federal government do this?
That's a good question. Part of it, I guess, is just a power thing, but part of it is I think the federal banking regulators, certainly during the Bush era, kind of saw themselves not as watchdogs, but as advocates for the industry, and they didn't want to do anything that would, in their minds, you know, harm the safety and soundness, i.e. the profits of big banks.
Recall there was that moment when Alan Greenspan told Brooksley Bourne, who was at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, that he didn't even think it was his role to prosecute fraud. So, you know, the market can take care of everything. I think we're just about out of time now. So I want to thank you, Michael Hudson, author of the book The Monster, just out from Times Books. And thanks for doing this and all the other work you've done over the years, because this is an important but underappreciated beat.
Great. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate the chance.
All right. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back in some form next week. And let's go out with this from a 60s proto-punk band, a bunch of GIs in Germany. I just really learned about the Monks. Till next week. Bye.